Running a business is a lot of work. Thankfully, Harvest makes it easier. Harvest is a project planning and time tracking tool that helps me keep my clients happy and my life a little bit less hectic. You can track clients and projects, manage time, send invoices, and a whole lot more. I've used it for years, and I hope you try it too. Check it out free at getharvest.com/strongfeelings, and when you sign up for a paid account, you'll get half off your first month. That's getharvest.com/strongfeelings for 50% off your first month.
I've been deprogrammed. I know who I am. Control has been lifted. It's all in my hands. I'll close my eyes.
Hey everyone, I'm Sarah.
And I'm Cattell.
And this is Strong Feelings, a podcast about work, friendship, and feminism, and what happens when you bring them all together.
Our guest today is Amy Westervelt. She's the author of Forget Having It All, How America Messed Up Motherhood, and How to Fix It. And she also runs the Critical Frequency Podcast Network, which we love. We met her at Work It, the podcast festival we went to last fall, because an acquaintance told us just, oh my gosh, you have to meet Amy. She's amazing. And it was so true. She's awesome.
Yes, it was really great to talk with somebody who, like us, has a lot of different things going on at any one time. You know, she's really busy, but also she's also a mom. And that's a perspective that neither of us have. So I thought that was so powerful to hear from her.
Oh, my gosh. I know. I can't wait to get into all of that. But before we do, I have not seen you in a minute. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. You know, I had a little bit of a busy week last week, and I'm feeling a little bit behind because I took some time off to go visit my mom in Arizona, and she's been dealing with some health stuff. And so I was both, you know, there for her and trying to spend time with my mom, but also I have a bunch of projects that are just starting to kick off, and I have a lot of just sort of things I needed to kind of keep moving forward. So I had a lot of like working, not working moments where I was like maintaining the veneer of working, you know, or I'm like getting the emails out the door, like getting a proposal out the door, whatever, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
While also really trying to be present and available for my mom.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm good, but I'm also feeling now like, okay, I didn't really like have a weekend, and now I've got to have this whole week where I get a lot of shit done. And, you know,
yeah,
it's sometimes a little tough.
It is tough. I totally get that. The first half of last week, actually, John and I were in Florida visiting my in-laws, and it was really nice to be somewhere warm, like not 6 degrees like it was here. But I was also still trying to like check in on work and get a few things done, and juggling that while being with family is super tough. And we were also just sort of in a dead zone of like connectivity. The cell towers were like not really working or something. And normally if I was on full vacation mode, I would have been like, oh, well, you know, too bad. I'm just like not reachable. But because I was like trying to check in and stay connected, it just like stressed me out a little bit.
I hate that feeling because, you know, yeah, on the one hand, it's like I don't want to be online the whole time. But also if you have a lot of things going on, you know, you don't necessarily want to be totally offline. And I just think like, I need to be prepared to be totally offline. Like, I don't want to be surprised by being totally offline. That does not work out well.
That is totally the feeling. And sort of in that vein, there's also something that happens for me, at least when I travel, and I don't really like think about what I'm eating. I just kind of like do whatever is easy instead of making a big effort because I'm, you know, I'm already like thinking about being somewhere else. But I realize that like when I'm traveling with family and, you know, sometimes it's stressful, it just like can take all my energy to be there and, you know, be like be easy versus making sure like I'm meeting all my own needs.
Yes, I totally know what you mean. You know, I definitely just sort of I'm like, no, mom, don't buy any groceries for me. I'm not here that long. But then I'm there and I'm like, gosh, there's really like not a lot happening here.
Or you're like used to your own stuff and you're kind of like,
totally.
Oh, this is different. It's the planning thing, you know. So when we left to go home, I was like, we were both ready.
Oh, boy. Was there anything good about your trip?
It was great. Don't mean to sound like it was, you know, like a terrible time. The best part was absolutely spending a bunch of time with my niece. She's so fucking awesome. She's like, she's 2 and she's getting like a real like personality and she's like sassy. And she was real sad when John and I left. So that was really sweet. Just made me think about how lucky we are that we live pretty close to our nieces and nephews, and it's nice to visit them a lot.
I wish I saw them more.
Oh, totally. You did make it out to see your nieces at Christmas, right?
Yeah, so I saw them at Christmas, and, you know, I took them to the ballet. So they're 6 and almost 4, and we went to see the Nutcracker, as you do. They were so excited about the idea and, like, you know, going to see, like, a real professional ballet. They've both taken ballet classes, whatever, right?
Yeah.
So we go to the Nutcracker, and I was a little bit surprised by this, but the younger niece, she was super into it. My older niece was just grumpy the whole time. Oh, no. She was such a miserable wreck the whole time we were there. And then there was also, like, just so much squirming.
So much squirming. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I accept it. I get it. But I'm also, I'm not, like, acculturated to it. Like, I don't live the squirm life, you know?
Yeah. Just, like, being near that. You're kind of like, oh, this is a different energy.
Yes. Yes. And it's a lot of energy. Yeah. I was also staying at my mom's house with my brother and his wife and their children, which meant a lot of people. Oh. So guess who slept on the air mattress in the living room?
Aunt Sarah.
Yes. Guess who got to be surprised by small children first thing in the morning, poking their little heads up over the back of the couch to see me in the air mattress?
Adorable the first day. Mm. And then...
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I was like, I need a door that closes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Love you. But I could really stand to have a door that closes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, it's kind of clear. I am not a parent. I am not quite prepared for the constant needs of small children.
Yeah.
But I do definitely like to spend time with them.
Yeah. I mean, neither one of us has kids. Like, did you always know you didn't want kids?
No, but I don't know that I ever really knew that I wanted them either. I think that I just sort of assumed that that was what people did for a really long time.
Yep.
I mean, in the same way that, like, I remember thinking that, like, 22 was a really good age to get married because that was the age my mom was when she got married. Sure. And then thinking about that now, I'm just like, oh, no.
This is terrible. You're like, oh, gosh.
I think that as I got older and sort of had more time to think about different ways adulthood could look and different experiences to see different ways that adulthood could look, eventually it kind of occurred to me that I didn't really want to have kids. And I sort of kept waiting to see if that was something that started to make a lot more sense to me or, like, sound important to me. And it just kept not happening. And then at some point I was like, I just don't think that that's what I really want, or I don't think that that's, like, a strong driver for me.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I had some, like, big proclamation. And in a lot of ways, I actually really resisted that because I felt like that's, like, a lot of pressure to have this binary choice. Like, you want kids or you don't want kids. And I was like, I don't think so, but I'm just not going to close that door until I feel like closing that door.
Yeah.
I don't know. How about you?
Yeah, that makes sense. Similar. I think, like, for a lot of my 30s, I actually was in that same boat where I was kind of like, well, I don't think I want them, but, like, I don't want to put a stake in the ground and say no, never. Because I also, you know, I was with a partner who I don't think was as necessarily decided. We were both, like, leaning in the same direction, but I think, like, his door was a lot more open. So I kind of wanted to, like, be able to have a conversation if it ever came up. It's definitely in the last, you know, I'd say 5 years or so, we are firmly like, no, this isn't right for us for a bunch of different reasons. But I also, I think, really, like, struggled with that idea of it being, like, so binary.
Yeah. As somebody who doesn't have kids, do you know what I really hate the most, though?
What?
I hate the judgment, the, like, weird judgment about that.
Yeah.
Like, as if that's anybody's business.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I know that when people do have kids, they also get judgment. And
people
who think that it's their business.
Yes.
But yeah, I really hate feeling like whether I have children or not is, like, something other people who I'm not partnered with should care about.
Yeah. What's the worst time you've ever been, like, really judged for it?
Okay, I don't know if this is the worst time, but it was so unexpected to me that it became very memorable. I remember it so clearly. So I was at my OBGYN, and she was a younger woman, and I was just there for, like, an annual exam. And so, you know, because she was a younger doctor who's probably, like, around my age at the time, like, early 30s, I sort of assumed that she'd be cool, which is maybe a bad assumption, you know? But we were having this conversation about IUDs. And one of the things she was telling me was, like, how quickly you can be fertile again after you remove it as, like, a selling point for them.
Sure.
Which is fine. I mean, that's a very reasonable thing to communicate, especially, you know, she was talking to, like, a married woman in a heterosexual relationship in her early 30s. So, like, statistically, that's probably useful information for a lot of people.
Right.
And I'm not mad that she wanted to talk about that. But then she asked me if I had plans for kids. And I was like, nah, I'm good. You know, I didn't say that.
Yeah.
I told her that I didn't think so. You know, I was most likely not going to have children, and I definitely wasn't planning on it in the near term. And I swear, she looks at me and she makes this big pouty face.
Ugh.
And she goes, "Aww, why not?
No."
Like, she was personally disappointed. And I mean, like, my mother has never had that kind of reaction.
Right.
And I'm like, lady, trust me, this does not affect your life at all.
Yeah, exactly. Let me make my decision.
I know. And so, okay, I actually switched doctors after, not just that, there was a couple other similarly judgy comments mm-hmm. where I was just like, I don't need this in my life.
No.
So anyway, what about you? What bugs you about how people talk to you about kids?
I mean, I think I just really don't love the trope that people who don't have kids are instead choosing a career. Like, I didn't decide not to have kids for my career or like in order to do the work that I'm doing. I'm sure it's true for some people, which is also a perfectly fine and reasonable decision. And I don't know, just as I figured out what I am going to focus on and prioritize in my life, it just hasn't been such a black and white decision. It's not one or the other. It's like, yes, I'm invested and excited about the work that I'm doing, and maybe that work takes up a lot of my time, which I really enjoy because I'm excited and passionate about it. But I also know about myself that I need a lot of solitude and I am really prone to anxiety. And for me, those don't jive with having kids, just for me. I also just simply don't have a strong desire for it, which I think, like you touched on earlier, and I think that's such an important thing to pay attention to. And, you know, I know that that doesn't necessarily make sense to some people, but it doesn't have to.
You know, I was thinking a little bit about some of the things that Amy said, and she talked a lot about as a parent, you know, having to make a lot of trade-offs. And mm-hmm. I think that that's relevant here. It's like, sure, are there career trade-offs when you have children, and are your trade-offs different because you don't have children? Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it's not, I think this idea that you're going to be choosing career or choosing kids is so damaging to every decision and all sides, you know. I think that it's important to recognize that there are tons of trade-offs that we are making every day, constantly, whether or not we have children. Like, trade-offs are part of life, but it's not a simple one for the other. It's a lot of different, like, small decisions that add up. And so there's just so much more nuance we need to have in this conversation.
Yeah, you know, one of the things we heard from Amy, too, is that, you know, you can do both. You can do, like, all the things that you want to do, but it just takes some reorganization and some reprioritization. And, like, yes, things might look different.
I think one of the other things, though, that Amy helped to highlight and that you see in a lot of places is that, you know, yes, you can pursue lots of different things as a parent, but there are a lot of really specific kind of structures working against being a parent in the workforce, or I should say, actually, specifically, let me be clear, being a mom. Mm. Like, did you know that there has been a number of studies, there's a lot of data about how, like, having a baby helps men's careers but hurts women's careers?
Yeah.
Some of it has been around for a while. Like, there is a study that came out a few years ago, it was 2014, that was showing that on average, men's earnings increase more than 6% when they have children, if those children live with them. But women's earnings decrease 4% for every child they have.
No, I'm shaking my head. No.
I mean, that's yeah, that's the reality, is that it's absolutely not the same. The way people interact with you at work is not the same. And sort of the anecdotal stories about how men are treated when they tell their bosses that they're going to have a kid versus how women are treated are so different. I remember I was working at an agency several years ago where there were a lot of dads who worked there. And there were very few moms. There are a couple moms, but the moms who worked there did not have little babies. They did not have toddlers. They had kids who were a bit older. And a couple of people got pregnant while I worked there, but nobody came back from maternity leave, which I think is really telling. And I'm not, it's totally fine to not come back from maternity leave. It's not that. What I think is telling is that this wasn't a workplace where people could come back from maternity leave.
Right.
I remember there was a woman I worked with who was really great at her job and really great to work with. I thought she was a really valuable employee. You know, she was awesome. So she had her first baby and she wanted to come back with some flex time. Now, it was very common in my office that people would work from home pretty regularly. They mostly didn't have a schedule like I work from home on Tuesdays and Thursdays or whatever, but people routinely worked from home one or two days a week. Not a big deal. So she wanted to have some flex time and she wanted a little bit more consistent schedule about when she was working from home. And her boss, who was a woman, actually, a woman who I had really looked up to before, she really, from my perspective, pushed her out because she was like, nope, this is a 24/7 job and you got to be available for your clients. And like, I'm sorry, her main client was like an amusement park or something.
Not critical. Maybe.
I don't know what kind of 3 a.m. amusement park disasters happen. Like, let's hope none.
Yeah.
I guess that might be a big problem if it did. But the reality was, I think that was just silly. And it was really, she basically was like, I'm not going to make any accommodations for you just because you had a baby. I mean, that's what the message was. And the thing is, humans need accommodations all the time because they're human. And she was great at her job. And I think she felt really pushed out. And, you know, one of the things that I realized about this other woman who I had looked up to, who had been, you know, a leader in this firm, was I think she had really internalized so much sexism and misogyny. And she was sort of like, well, I had to do all of this to get ahead. So you should have to do it too, right? So like, why should I have any accommodations for you? Because I had to push my way through this man's world by myself. And like, that just sucks. Like, that's not a mentality that I want to carry forward. And so that's what I really realized, that she wasn't somebody that I could look up to in that regard, because that's not a world that I want. I want to be able to say like, wow, that was hard for me when it shouldn't have been. And I would like to make it easier for the next people so that they can focus on just doing great work.
Yeah, anyone deserves and to want and make happen for them like more flexible work time or, you know, accommodations that help them do their job better. It's like, it doesn't matter. And I don't know. I really don't like the assumption that if you don't have kids, you must have an endless amount of time to, you know, to do work. And if you do have kids, you must not be a career go-getter. You're only on the baby train.
And yeah, and I think, you know, you're really highlighting too, that it feels like you're kind of fucked either way, because, you know, obviously, like, if you have kids, then there's like this perception of you not being serious about your job or whatever, right? And it's like, oh, you must not actually want that promotion because you're having a baby. But also, if you don't have kids, there's this perception that, yeah, you should be able to throw it all in all the time on work, right? Like, I don't actually think that, for example, this agency, it was a 24/7 job for anybody, whether they had an infant at home or not, right? Like, it is not that important.
Yeah.
But there's also this perception too, like, I think that if you try to set boundaries as a person without children, then somehow you're being selfish, that it's like, it's selfish that you want time for yourself, or it's selfish that you, you know, like, you're not going to work on the weekend or whatever because you want to binge Netflix, where it's like, no, like, that should be okay. Like, you should not have to give everything to work or everything to children or everything to anything, right? Like, that you should have some autonomy over how you decide to spend your one very small little bit of life that you have.
Yes.
Anyway, something that I really loved when we were talking to Amy is that she helped to drive home how much all of us really need to care about this, sort of in whatever life we're in, right? So, for example, men need to care a ton about issues around things like maternity leave and, you know, family leave in general, but specifically around, like, how does your office treat working moms? I think that that's super important, because ultimately, like, the way that an office is going to look at somebody like a working mother, that is a reflection of how they look at people, how they look at humans. And I just think, you know, we are so interconnected, like, we're so reliant on each other to make any community work. But American culture is so individualistic. And I think what we're really seeing is just the ways that that individualism is a lie, right? Like, the way that it breaks for everyone. So for me, you know, I want to be really informed about and advocate for moms and families with kids, even though that's not my life. Because workplaces that work for moms, I think, are just better for everyone.
Completely. I learned so much from Amy. Let's talk to her.
Amy Westervelt is a journalist, a podcast host and producer, the founder of a podcast network called Critical Frequency, a mother, and the author of a fantastic new book called Forget Having It All, How America Messed Up Motherhood and How to Fix It. Amy, there is a lot in there. Welcome to Strong Feelings.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the book, Forget Having It All. It just came out in the fall. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And we read that you wrote the book after you had kind of had a revelation in your own parenting life. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about that story.
Yeah. So my second child was a total mistake. I mean, that sounds bad, but not planned. And also, like, I had really decided that I was going to have just one kid and that was it. And at the time I was, you know, self-employed, and my husband was trying to start a company, so he didn't have an income. So I was supporting all of us. And also because I was self-employed, I didn't have maternity leave. So I took off literally an afternoon to have a baby, and mostly also didn't even tell the people that I was working for that I was pregnant, because with my first son, I did tell people, and like 80% of my freelance work disappeared and never came back. So I was really kind of nervous about that. And then the thing that like really, really made me think, oh, I want to write more about this, was that I felt kind of proud of myself for like really not even pausing a beat to have a kid. And I felt like that was kind of a messed up thing to feel. You know, I was like, why am I patting myself on the back for the fact that like no one even knew I was pregnant, you know, like go me. So anyway, I wanted to look at both, you know, the history of how certain expectations of women vis-a-vis motherhood came about and how those things sort of like shaped policies that impact women, whether they have kids or not, but also how feminism then kind of added on to that in not always positive ways.
What do you mean by that? So what are some of the ways that that hasn't necessarily been positive?
A lot of the sort of second wave of feminism was really kind of trying to turn women into men, essentially. You know, it's a lot of like, oh, like we need to get in the workforce and we need to kind of mimic the success path that men have been on, right? And in a lot of ways, that sort of automatically counts out mothers. And there was actually like kind of infighting in the feminist movement. And still today, you'll find it of people basically thinking that like, if you choose to have kids, that you're choosing to basically like subjugate yourself to the patriarchy. And I mean, it does kind of feel that way. And it's not that like, I think that system doesn't exist or that you aren't taking on a role that has a lot of patriarchal baggage to it. However, I kind of feel like the idea that it has to be that way or that something that only women do should be considered a negative by the feminist movement seems strange to me. I also feel like, you know, like lean in style of more kind of corporate feminism has really contributed to this feeling that like the goal should be that women are doing everything. And I feel like that contributed certainly personally to my feeling of like, oh, wow, I'm so great. I had a baby and I didn't even take time off and I didn't even tell anyone I was pregnant. Like, what a power woman, you know? And I think there are some issues with that kind of notion.
Yes, absolutely. We've talked about a little of this on the show. You know, me and Cattell aren't parents, but we've definitely talked about the sort of idea that what it means to be powerful or successful or ambitious is to be pushing the whole time. And it's like, well, what about being a human? And what about the idea that, you know, taking breaks is good? What about the idea that it's okay to acknowledge like, hey, actually, I just had a baby and like, I need time, and making a world where that is more okay.
Yeah. And also, I don't know any men that want that life either. You know what I mean? It's like, why are we striving for this thing that like the people who kind of invented it and first benefited from it don't want either, you know?
Yeah. I remember you wrote an article before the book that got a lot of interest that was about sort of the way that having it all kind of sucks. And in that article, you talked a lot about how sort of stressed out you were and sort of realizing, like, I don't know, it all coming crashing down on you, that you did have this second child and so much work to do and so much laundry to do. And, you know, I'm really curious, when that article sort of blew up and you started looking at writing a book, was that kind of a scary thing to do, to kind of add one more thing to your list?
Because the essay that I wrote, which I wrote like in the middle of the night, I really like didn't think anyone was going to read that. And then it went crazy. And I was like, oh, there's a lot of editing I would have done had I known so many people were going to read this. But my agent was like, oh, you should write a book proposal about this. And initially, I kind of was like, I don't really have time for that. But then it was kind of easy to write. And I feel like when things are easy to write, those are the things that like you should be writing. So I kind of already knew what I wanted to look into. And then on the research side, it's kind of like my dream to just like be in a library all day long. So for me, it felt like a huge luxury. The one thing that did add major stress was that I did not understand that the word advance in book publishing does not mean that you actually get anything in advance.
Oh my gosh, this was a sad, sad, sad thing I also learned. Any of our listeners out there thinking about advances, an advance is also usually broken up into multiple parts, and some of them come not actually before the book comes out, but you're like, in advance of what precisely?
Yeah, exactly. I know. I was thinking that I would get money in advance so that I would be able to sort of like take time away from other work to be able to do the book. But I didn't get my first check until after I had like submitted the manuscript already. So that was super stressful. And my husband actually like was kind of off and on working. He was doing some consulting work. So he was able to sort of plan his work around being able to sort of be the primary parent if I needed to like go away and do research. Or like, we have a lot of cheap motels around where we live. So there were like several times where he was like, just go to a hotel for like the day and like get a bunch of stuff done. And so I did do a lot of that, which was kind of the only way it could have happened, really.
What are some of the things that you learned about family leave policies and cultural attitudes about, you know, working parents and working moms that surprised you?
One thing about the sort of initial wave of colonists from Europe was that there was a lot about the way that they approached religion that has crept into how we approach families and therefore a lot of like work-life stuff. They were Puritans of the Calvinist tradition, which meant that they kind of believed that every person was able to interpret the Bible on their own, right? They were very big on rejecting the aristocracy in general, and that included in the church. So it's like, well, this idea that like a bishop, for example, has like a better understanding of the Bible and can tell me what I should be thinking about my relationship with God was something that they sort of generally rejected. And that I didn't realize that like the sort of American individualism thing wasn't just that these people had like left everything that they knew and come to this place that they didn't know anything about and whatever, but also that like that was kind of their approach to life in general. And then the way that that kind of bleeds into the family thing is that they really doubled down on the whole nuclear family idea. So like this had started happening a little bit in Europe and in England, but in America, it took on a sort of extreme form, in part because these were people who were physically away from their extended family, right? So there was no way to really have like, you know, the sort of family village that we talk about today. And then also because in each family, the father was in charge of not just the household, but also to make sure that everyone in the family like made it to heaven. So it was this very, very much like, I don't know, they were just sort of like responsible to themselves. And they did have community involvement and the church and all that stuff. But ultimately, each family was really sort of an island unto itself. And I feel like you really see the reverberations of that all throughout our history. Like it's still very much ingrained in people's minds today that families should work shit out on their own.
Who needs universal healthcare?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's the thing that I think it's interesting too, is like a lot of times, you know, when we talk about, I don't know, the politics of motherhood or work-life balance or whatever, like sometimes people will be like, oh, well, I don't have kids, so that doesn't apply to me. But actually like these things really impact a lot of policies that really kind of affect everyone and definitely impact how the workplace has been set up. So I think it's kind of interesting for people to understand the forces behind this stuff. Cause also I feel like we have this tendency to be like, that's just how it is, you know? And it's like, well, no, there was actually like a small group of people who had some pretty crazy ideas and like, we could totally change. We're different people with different ideas. Like we should be able to change things.
Yeah. You know, we talk about this a lot. We don't have kids, but we understand that we need to have workplaces that are okay for people who have kids, both because those people are people who are valuable, but also because it's like, okay, well, if you're in a culture that doesn't allow for that, it's like, well, what else doesn't it allow for? What kinds of norms does that create that actually do affect everybody? And if you want to think about it as sort of like, we need to have a cultural system that understands that humans are humans, which means that things happen to them or that they have a variety of stuff going on in their life. Like that's something that's true for everybody, right?
Yeah, and that there's a certain amount of caregiving that's required to make society work. And that can be in the form of parenthood. It can be in the form of taking care of elderly people. It can be in the form of taking care of yourself. You know, like there are all of those things are kind of necessary for, you know, even if you want to look at it purely from an economic standpoint, like those things are necessary for the economy to continue to run too. So this kind of constant dismissal of those things is a problem. And the other thing is too, I write about this in the book a little bit, and I'm working on a piece about it now. What's happened in the absence of workplace or governmental policies that support any kind of life outside of work, and especially that support working parents, is that a lot of times people without children are being asked to shoulder that burden. So like, I know in my case, I worked at a public radio station for a while. And at one point in time, we were all women in the newsroom, and all but one of us had kids. And the woman who didn't have kids was constantly being asked to work overtime, to work weekends, to be the person who's like on call and can drop everything. And like there was one night where I was leaving and she was staying late yet again. And I was like, you know, it's really unfair that you keep getting asked to do this just because you don't have kids. Like it doesn't mean you don't have a life, you know? And she was like, I really appreciate you saying that, because it's also this thing that I feel like I can't say anything about, because then I'm like being a bad feminist and not supporting other women. And I was like, oh man, like that's something that A, like we need to be able to have conversations about this stuff more openly, because there should, you know, oftentimes there's a way that you could like arrange the schedule so that everyone is kind of picking up slack where they can, you know, but also like, it's totally unfair that people without kids are being asked to sort of close the gap on policy issues.
It's almost like we've got a patriarchal culture that punishes women no matter what they do.
Exactly. Yeah. Because also too, it's often the women without kids that are being asked to shoulder the burden much more often than the men. Our whole society is about individual success, right? But who's constantly being asked to put themselves aside for the greater good? Women.
And who gets to have individual success because so many women are putting themselves aside for the greater good?
Exactly.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting to kind of dig into all of these assumptions that get tied together. And I'm curious, you know, from there, I know that when we start talking about things like how do we deal with parenthood in the workplace and how do we deal with paid leave, et cetera, we start hearing from people that it's like, oh, we should just have a system like they have in Sweden.
Right.
And that's called out as like this gold standard. And it does sound like a dream in a lot of ways. But one of the things I know you've written about is how that might not actually be a very useful example for us in America, or that's not necessarily, you know, a straightforward thing to work toward. And I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the ideas that I have for improving things are along Scandinavian lines too. However, I think that the thing that gets missed out of that conversation a lot is the fact that we also need to shift cultural and social norms in order for policies like that to actually work. I hear a lot of people being like, Sweden, and not really taking into account that like, okay, you could very easily implement Swedish policies here and have like minimal uptake of them, because the culture still punishes people for behaving in that way. So I started looking around to see if anyone else had done this, had like gone from a sort of patriarchal capitalist society and tried to implement Scandinavian policies. And I realized that Japan had done exactly that. So they had sent like a contingent of people over to Sweden and Denmark and Norway to do some research, gather up some information, write down specific policies, and bring them back and implement them. And so they came out, I mean, it was like all the things that you hear about here that will like solve the problem, right? It's like equal paternity leave, flex time for working parents, paid daycare, subsidized daycare, extended maternity leave. They were even like giving actual like paid incentives to have kids, because they're like very worried about their birth rate, which is another thing that we're hearing about all the time in the US right now. So what they found was that more than a third of fathers in particular wanted to be taking advantage of these policies, but only 3% actually were. And it was mostly because they just felt like, even though technically it was allowed, it would be frowned upon. And so they started doing maybe 10, 15 years ago, this whole kind of like propaganda campaign around involved fatherhood. So they had like all these posters of like famous guys, you know, like wearing their babies or like, you know, coaching their kids' soccer team or whatever. And you have seen, like, I've talked to a bunch of people who grew up in Japan and are now in their like 40s or 50s. And they're like, oh yeah, like it's definitely like you see stuff now that you would never have seen when I was young. You see a lot of like dads with baby carriers and strollers, and you see them like showing up to kids' events. And like, that was just not a thing 10, 20 years ago. But then they realize, oh, we need to get at the workplace culture thing. So they now, I think just about 2 years into a program that is aimed at specifically executives and bosses at big companies to try to train them around the idea that like, this is actually positive for the workforce. And they have a big emphasis around elder care now too, because the other impact of the declining birth rate is that you have a huge elder care problem in Japan. And you have a lot of employees who might not have kids, but have elderly parents that they really like have to take some time out to help. So they're sort of managing all of that. And I just feel like that's probably a more useful example for us in terms of, okay, what are the cultural norms that we have in place that would be a blocker to policies actually being effective?
Yeah, I love that story so much because I think it does speak to some of those cultural factors that are going to get in the way of any policy change here. And also I think to like the idea that what you're really talking about is kind of the long game. Like this isn't a short-term solution. But speaking kind of practically for somebody listening who's looking at this and thinking like, okay, well, what should we be doing? Like, what should I be doing in my workplace? What should I be doing in my home? What should I be doing in my local government? Like, what would you advocate for people to start with?
I feel like a big part of it is just normalizing certain things. So like, for example, I've been talking to a lot of people about creating stronger networks with other parents of your kids' friends or coworkers who also have kids, and like trying to figure out ways to better support each other. And then I also feel like actually like talking to bosses about this stuff in situations that are not sort of fraught and charged, you know, like talking to your boss about needing time off the moment that you need it, and then getting into the discussion about how the workplace supports family is like, it's almost destined to fail because like you're in an emotional state at that point, you know? So I actually like, there's a company that I consulted with for a while. There was a woman there I thought did a really masterful job at this because she was very pragmatic with her boss. And she just sort of brought it up to him like, hey, you know, I think we'd have an easier time recruiting really talented women if we did a couple things to make the workplace like a little more accommodating to women in particular. And at that point, she didn't have kids and she wasn't talking necessarily about the work-life balance thing. She was more just like, we have a bro culture, you know? Mm-hmm. And so then he was kind of like, oh, like I'm open to that. And so she kind of pulled together a group of women at the office who were all interested in looking at ways to get at this. And they started kind of implementing some pretty subtle things like, okay, we're going to have like a woman on every client call. And we're going to have whenever we're like presenting about like successful projects and stuff like that, right? And like, we should try to have at least like a couple women a quarter, you know, things like that, that were like really like had no negative impact on anyone, you know, because they were kind of happening behind the scenes, but it did start to sort of gradually shift. And then once they got that going, then it's like, okay, well, let's talk about how we can arrange our flex time policy to give people like a little bit more control who like need to pick up kids early or who want to leave the office at like 4 because they are training for a marathon or whatever. And then they'll be back online at 6. And so now, like 2 years later, she had a kid and that workplace is like extremely perfect for her because she like helped to start to put those things in place long before they were an urgent need for her. It was just quite kind of like something that she saw in the workplace that she wanted to change. So that all takes a lot of time and a lot of patience and, you know, a lot of emotional energy. And again, often falls to women to do. But I do think that those kinds of things really help because a lot of times it is really kind of being able to show examples of these things that help to kind of move the needle. The other thing too is that there's actually a ton of research around how both flex time to a certain extent, although people have to kind of be careful with how they implement it, and on-site daycare are huge drivers of productivity and retention and all kinds of things that actually are positive for the bottom line. So I kind of think, like, in the workplace conversation in particular, shifting the way we talk about it a little bit away from the language that I feel like often the GOP uses to get rid of these things, which is like, it's like a cost and it's a responsibility and you're asking the company to like take care of something that's your personal thing and whatever, to like, you know, really looking at, hey, like, this is something that's good for productivity, the bottom line, all that stuff.
And, you know, I mean, I think about this a lot in terms of like things that I wish more men would do. I've definitely heard of people within tech, this is a big thing because, you know, there tends to be these like high salaries, people who have lots of options for lots of different jobs, which puts them in this place where they have relative power. And, you know, hearing men say things like, oh, I started asking potential employers about their family leave policies. And I started saying that that was a factor, whether or not I had kids or wanted kids, that I wanted to know about that. And it's like, oh yeah, normalizing that this is a thing that just people ask about and that people expect that you have, to me was really powerful. So it's not just on you when you're the one who's pregnant, it's on all of us every time we have a conversation about it.
Yes, totally. There was a period of time where I was mostly reporting on business and I was often on tech because I was in the Bay Area. And I started asking male CEOs how they balance family and work because it's just like not something, I mean, it's like ridiculous how, you know, every woman CEO gets asked that, right? And if they don't have kids, they get asked about like, did your career come into that decision and whatever, you know? So I started, I think like little things like that are helpful too, because it gets them thinking about like, oh, well, how do I do that? Like oftentimes it's like, you know, I have a lot of paid help or I have a spouse who's a full-time parent, you know?
Absolutely. I think that's a great question.
It totally is. And that is definitely something I want to ask a little bit more about is like, in addition to writing the book and being a parent yourself to two small kids, you're also the founder of an indie podcast network called Critical Frequency and a freelance journalist and the host of some of the podcasts on your network. How did you find time to write the book given, you know, all the other stuff happening in your life?
I mean, the honest answer is like, I don't get that much sleep. I often have to stop work at 4 and deal with my kids until about 8 and then get back to work at like 8:30 and work until 1:30 or 2. And then they get up at like 6. So I like fortunately have always been a person who functions fine on like 4 hours of sleep, although I'm sure that that's like not healthy for the long run. And it is something that it's sort of situational too. It's like, that's been my schedule this year. Next year, I'm like, okay, I'm going to try to really just focus on the podcast network and not take on as much freelance journalism. I kind of was like, okay, for this year, I'm going to do this really like crazy schedule and get some stuff done. Because also, I mean, the reality is that you do kind of postpone your own life for a certain amount of time when you have kids, whether you take time off or not. Like, even though, okay, I didn't take any time off, but because of the financial burden, I had to basically take on a bunch of like marketing, copywriting jobs, consulting jobs, like stuff that isn't my actual career, just to be able to make enough money, you know? But yeah, for me, it was just sort of like, well, I kind of felt like I had some catching up to do on things that I had wanted to do, you know, 2 years prior had been sort of like derailed. So yeah, now I don't know, recently, for some reason this year, I think I probably like burned myself out on the late night thing. So I can now basically not stay up past 11 anymore. So my new thing is waking up at 4 and doing work before the kids get up, which actually I think I might be a morning person. I'm actually a little bit more productive in those hours than I was at night. So shifted it around a little bit. But yeah, I mean, the whole, like, the childcare thing is a pain too. Like, I have one kid in school and I thought that, you know, that was going to make things so much easier, but it's actually worse. Like, I really feel like this is a big culture thing that needs to shift too, that I feel like almost never gets talked about. The public school system in the US is 100% set up for families that have at least one full-time parent, which is like 25% of American families now. So it, like, that needs to change. Yeah, they're constantly like, oh, today we're going to have a minimum day surprise. Or like, today, like, we need parents to show up at 11 a.m. for, you know, some event or whatever. And the shitty part about that too is that if you can't make it, not only do you feel bad because you didn't go, but like, is like creating sort of like negative experiences for the kids too, because then they're like, oh, my mom was the only one that didn't come or whatever, you know. And
But I mean, it's not,
you're bringing back a lot of memories for me from being like in volleyball and like my mom never could come to the games.
Yes, which I'm sure she felt bad about too. Yeah
She tried very hard.
Totally.
So you are doing a lot. You're not sleeping enough. What do you do when you have those moments right now where you still feel like, you know, you're kind of failing at being a mom or failing at work or failing at all of it at the same time? Like, how do you get through that, all of those, you know, potential negative feelings?
Yeah. I mean, I have those feelings together often. And like, I definitely think about, I think it's funny that my book is called Forget Having It All. And yet here I am trying to do like five things at once, you know, I'm not doing a good job of forgetting it. So when I start feeling really, really overwhelmed, the thing that kind of helps me the most is to just like go be alone, whether that is like sitting in a room for 10 minutes or going on a walk or whatever. I have to do that. And occasionally my husband will still be like, maybe you should go spend the night at a hotel.
I mean, I think that's brilliant.
I mean, yeah.
So you mentioned that you are going to focus more on critical frequency this year. Tell us a little bit more about that. Like, what drove you to build your own podcast network rather than join an existing one or stay independent?
Yeah. So I was working at a public radio station and had been working there for a couple of years and had kind of realized like, oh, okay, sort of deal with a lot of NPR news is that you get a lot of tape and then you basically get rid of everything that's not fact, just a straight fact being shared, you know? So for me, I felt like, oh, there's so much storytelling that people do. And that's the part that's kind of interesting to me about reporting is that I get to talk to a lot of people who don't often get asked about themselves and who get really excited to tell me their story, you know? So a friend of mine and I started a podcast to basically like use all of our extra tape, and it did fairly well. And then I sort of caught the bug and was like, this would be a good idea for a podcast. I'll make it, you know? And then at a certain point I realized that I was making, between like the ones I was doing myself and the ones that I was helping other people with, I was working on like four or five podcasts at a time. And this was when a lot of like the platforms were giving much more attention to networks than they were to individual podcasts necessarily. So I thought, oh, well, we basically have a network anyway. I'm hosting all these feeds through one account already. Why don't we just do this and like see if it helps? But I also kind of looked around the industry and felt like, okay, as it's getting more professionalized, it's starting to kind of look a lot like other media and really be dominated by like the same people who dominate every other channel of media, which is mostly like middle-aged white men. So I felt like not only did that mean that there were probably certain stories or types of stories that were getting left out, but also because they all had come from only a public radio background, I felt like on the business side, there were a lot of things that were being missed too. So that time, like in a lot of the rest of my work life, I was sort of having to do work, like whatever work paid the most, and it was mostly not work I enjoyed. So having this, outlet to be able to 100% control what I was doing from both a business perspective and a creative perspective was something that actually really kind of helped me get through the year. And having a diversity of voices is not about checking a box or being able to brag about it in marketing materials. I genuinely feel like that diversity brings value. And that's held true. I think that this year we're putting out a couple different shows that have formats that like I've never heard anywhere else. We're dealing with a lot of people whose stories are just not what I'm hearing on other networks. And it is actually bringing in an audience to us. And I think like we're in a position to just sort of think more creatively about how to find audiences, how to build revenue, all of those kinds of things. So it's exciting for me and it's worked out. Like I'm now drawing a full-time salary from the podcast network.
That's great. Before we go, though, I want to make sure that we can ask you a little bit for some insight, both because you're an expert on things like parental leave and also because you're a parent. And we know a lot of our listeners have kids and they tell us, you know, they're trying to juggle like all of these competing desires, right? Like they want to have time with their families. They want to do the right thing as parents. They also want to go on walks in the woods by themselves. They want to pursue all of their different career ambitions and creative projects. And then they also want to have their own kind of like sense of identity. And you've written a lot about this and you've written about, you know, forget having it all, like you mentioned, while you're also still kind of trying to. What do you tell parents and especially mothers who are struggling to kind of come to terms with the trade-offs that they need to make? Or what do you tell people who are trying to decide which trade-offs are right for them?
I think the main thing that I've kind of come to is that you have to stagger things and you have to kind of be okay with that. And also realize that actually not doing all those things right at this second is okay. You can actually be like, you know what, this year I have a baby and I just need to be able to feel like an okay parent, get the hang of this thing and keep like one foot in my career. I think you kind of have to pick two things. And this is advice that I'm like giving myself right now too, because I've just spent a year where I did three things and it was definitely one too many. If I had it to do all over again and I had a newborn and a job at the same time, I think I would spend a considerable amount of time building out a network of people and, you know, some paid, some not, that would enable me to be able to do like a few other things without feeling like I'm abandoning my kid or doing a bad job of parenting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So investing in that community building, which of course can be really hard for people. And yeah, especially for any of us who don't have endless money to spend on paid help, it's very difficult.
Yeah, it is. Trading off, like finding another mom that's in like a similar position and figuring out ways to trade off can be super, super helpful. Like we did that for a while when we just had no money for babysitters. Well, A, like my husband and I did it with childcare in general, where like we couldn't afford childcare. So we would just stagger our work schedules so that like we were trading off taking care of the kid. But then also with friends, we would trade off date nights. So that like, you know, I would take care of all the kids one night and then my friend would take care of all the kids one night so that we could like go out without having to pay for babysitters. So like little things like that, that you can do to get yourself some time, I think is kind of crucial.
I love that. And I also, you know, I like to take care of my friends' kids when I can or do some babysitting for them, which I think is the kind of thing that, yeah, that more of us who aren't having kids could totally do.
Yeah.
Well, we are definitely out of time. So we want to wrap up by just asking you, you know, where can our listeners find out more about you and your book and your work?
Well, the Critical Frequency Podcast Network is on all platforms, and I host a show called Drilled on there that's not at all about parenting. It's about climate change, which is kind of tangentially related. And I also host a show called Tell Me About Your Mother, where I talk to people about their mothers, and oftentimes, like, you know, my stuff kind of comes out too. And then I have a website It's just amywesterbelt.com. And there's a bunch of stuff on there about the book and, you know, whatever I'm writing recently and all of that. So yeah. Oh, and on Twitter at Amy Westerbelt.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It was awesome talking with you. Thank you.
Yeah, you too. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
I'm Bea Beeman. I'm a singer-songwriter and producer. I'm a dad, and I'm an American. Peace of Mind is an experiment. It's my new album, but I'm releasing it as a podcast. I was born on the bottom. I'll dig into the issues that inspired these songs with guests like Reza Aslan.
None of this is permanent. It could change like that.
And Rabia Chowdhury.
That's America. The great thing is we can do something to change it.
Subscribe on your favorite podcast app and join us for some Peace of Mind.
Okay. I have a huge fuck yeah this week.
Ooh, what is it?
Me and you are going to host our very first big workshop together.
Oh my gosh. I'm so excited. It's at Lead Dev in New York, which is a conference in April. And I'm so pumped because I've just heard so many good things about that conference.
Yeah, I have too. And I'm really excited about this because it's the first proper thing that we have kind of out there that we came up with on our beach retreat a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
So I'm really excited that we were able to put something together, put together this workshop curriculum and get it out there and into an event. And it's still, you know, just a few weeks after we had the retreat. So that's really exciting to see that work come together.
I know. It's so exciting. It's like really cool to see something that we were talking about just recently, like actually like come to life.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll tell people about the workshop just like a little bit. So the workshop is all about sharing your work. Like, this is something I feel pretty strongly about. You know, I do a lot of speaking, I do a lot of writing. And so what we're going to talk about is things like, if you work in tech or design, how do you find a topic that you want to speak or write about or want to be known for? Like, how do you develop that kind of perspective? And how do you get confidence to present that at work, like in internal sessions or at meetups or at conferences, all of that stuff. So I'm really excited to take some of like the things that I feel like I've built as expertise and help more people learn about them.
I know, I can't wait either. I've been thinking so much about the work I do with authors at A Book Apart and helping them develop their books from like the initial pitch through the final product, working with them on marketing and selling that book so that it's like, you know, a meaningful addition to their professional lives and their professional personas. And because I'm only sort of working with a handful of people at A Book Apart at a time, I'm just so excited to have an opportunity to hopefully help and work with like a lot more folks.
Yes. And you know, I've spent so many of the past years writing for other people in my field and speaking about stuff in my field. And I've gotten to do that in so many cool places. Like, it has allowed me to see a lot of parts of the world, which has been pretty cool. That's not everybody's goal necessarily, but that's something that has been pretty cool for me. It's also gotten me more comfortable in front of a lot of different types of groups. Like, I've talked to a lot of students, I've talked to a lot of executives, I've talked to like everybody in between. And I want to kind of share more of what I've learned. And I want to make sure that I'm making some space for more people to be able to get out there and have their ideas heard. And particularly, you know, when I first started speaking, I remember that I would go to a lot of events and there would be like no other women or one other woman who was speaking. And that was a little bit lonely. In the events that I go to, that has gotten a lot better. A lot of that is also because I will not speak at events that are not more diverse than that.
Sure.
So as that has changed for me, that's something I also want to think about is like, what is my role in helping that change even further? So like, is it time for me to, I don't know, kind of like cede some of that space that I have had to some new voices and to some people who are more underrepresented in the field? And like, how can I invest some of my professional visibility that I've built into helping other people become visible?
I love that. I think that's so important for us to keep in mind, like, as we do this together. It's really, really exciting part of it.
Yeah. So the Lead Dev Conference is, you know, lead developers, right? So it's more focused on engineering. But we're really doing this workshop for anybody in like tech design, sort of loosely speaking, who just wants to feel more confident and prepared to share ideas. So if you're interested in that, you can check it out at bit.ly/leaddevnyc. But we're going to be doing this workshop as much as we can this year. I think we're going to have a couple short versions too, so like half day or couple hour versions. So I'm very excited about that. And I just want to say, fuck yeah to us launching a workshop and putting our work out there. And like, huge fuck yeah to helping more people put their voices and ideas out there.
Yes, fuck yeah.
Fuck yeah. Well, that is it for us this week. Strong Feelings is recorded in Philadelphia, and it's produced by Steph Colburn at Edit Audio. Our theme music is Deprogrammed by Blowdryer. Check them out at blowdryer.bandcamp.com. And thanks to Amy Westervelt for being our guest today. And thank you all for listening. If you liked our show, don't forget to subscribe and rate us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And hey, make sure you get Strong Feelings right in your inbox. You can get our newsletter by going to strongfeelings.co. See you again next week.
I've been deprogrammed. I know who-